We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an internationally known technology writer. His name is Julian Dibble, and we'll be talking about some of his experiences living and working in the virtual world. This is a story that he tells in a book that was published just a couple of years ago. The title of the book is Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. This book was first published in 2006 and then has now come out in paper. And if you want to read it, Basic Books is the publisher, and I'm sure that you can find it. And in this book, early on in this book, he writes about the fact that he declared in the spring of 2003 to his family and friends that he was embarking on a new profession. He said that he was going to start a business selling make-believe commodities, and he was going to get rich doing it, or at least he was determined that he would see if he could make more money doing that than he made from his freelance writing. And we'll talk about how that all came out here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest here is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois this spring. He's the George Miller Visiting Professor in the College of Media, also in the Center for Advanced Study. And near the end of next month, near the end of March, he'll be giving a talk about some of these same things we'll be talking about here this morning. The title, Ludo-Capitalism, Real Money from Play Economies and How I Made It. This will be on March 30th, that's a Tuesday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. This is an event that is free and open to the public. It's part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. So people here in and around Champaign-Urbana, note that down on your calendar. If you would like to hear more from him, he'll be doing that. Here this morning on the program, we'll talk, and questions are certainly welcome. Our guest has published books, essays, and articles on a number of subjects, including virtual worlds, social media, online communities, hackers, bloggers, etc. He is a non-resident fellow of Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society, and we're pleased to have him here this morning in the studio. One more thing, I better give you the telephone numbers if you want to call in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may email your questions and comments as well to will-talk at illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be here, David. Thank you.
For some people, I think the kind of online worlds that we're talking about, even people who maybe are familiar with the idea of a video game, these kinds of things, the massive multiplayer online role-playing game, will be like foreign country to them. And maybe that even is the wrong metaphor because some people don't even know that these things exist. Give us the thumbnail introduction to what with the MMO, what they are.
Well, the key elements are that they are massively multiplayer. That's the M and the M. Many thousands, in some cases even millions of players converging in these online worlds. And what's particularly distinctive about them is that unlike a typical video game where you play the game and you beat it or you don't and it's over, these games go on forever and ever. These worlds are persistent. And so the people that interact in them, that come together to try to achieve goals within the game, kill a certain monster, storm a certain castle, are all going to be dealing with each other week in, week out. And this starts to create some pretty interesting and in some cases bizarre social phenomena.
Yeah. These include things that people will probably have heard of. Maybe the big one is the World of Warcraft.
World of Warcraft.
Which is both, I'm sure, much loved and much mocked out there
yeah.
in the culture.
Yeah.
There is also something that it's a little bit different because it's not doesn't quite have those sorts of fantasy elements, but Second Life is also something that people have thought of, where people can create a character that will embody them, and then they live. And they have houses and apartments and jobs, and they go to clubs, and they go out on dates, and they have friends, and do many of the things that people do in their regular lives, yet they do them within the world of this of the game. And I don't know if it's correct to say Second Life is a game, but it's has the same sort of qualities as some of these other things.
Yeah, and what I've been focusing on is that the for a lot of these games, and for both Second Life and for World of Warcraft, the basic social glue is the built-in economy. And so in World of Warcraft, it is all about acquiring special weapons and powers. And you might go out and kill a dragon, and by killing the dragon, you get a super-duper sword with super-duper powers. But you can't use that because you are a healing priest who doesn't need a sword. He needs a special wand. Somewhere on the other side of the world of Azeroth, this fantasy world, a warrior has killed a dragon and gotten the super-duper wand. How do you get the wand and he gets the sword? Well, you trade. But you may not ever come into contact with each other. So how do you, you know, sort of spread that trading around these communities of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people by instituting an economy with its own currency, with its own marketplaces? And so almost as soon as these games were created, they had these complex internal economies. What I've been writing about is that these internal economies began almost immediately to spill out into the larger economy. So it takes a lot of dragon killing, for instance, to get that wand or to get that sword, a lot of time. And that's how the games are designed, to make you spend a lot of time achieving these things. Some people don't have that much time. And they want to play with their friends. They want to catch up with their friends, but they don't have time. So they might go, back in the old days, this is how it worked, they would go onto eBay and look for another player that had achieved this sword and didn't need it and wanted to sell it for real money. And there it would be, up for auction on eBay for $10, $50, sometimes $500, even $1,000. I mean, crazy prices for these things. And they would find buyers. And this began to flourish, this what's called real money trading, or RMT in the business. And that's what I set out to make my living in that year of living virtually.
Now, I want to just for a second here back up to make sure that people who are listening have got this, what it is we're talking about here. Because they might say, okay, I get the idea that we have these fantasy games that take place in these virtual worlds, and that people go into them and they embody characters and they do things and they go on quests. And it is possible within the context of the game to earn currency of that realm. And then you can use that currency and to buy things in that realm. But what you're saying now is you're taking it to an entirely different level. What you're saying is that actually there are people who are interested in buying virtual things that exist in the realm of the game, and they're actually paying real world money for them. They're paying real dollars for magical swords that can be purchased in the game for the currency of that magical world.
Right.
But we have taken that out now, and apparently people have actually looked at these virtual worlds and done things like calculated their GNPs.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that still places it in the realm of the game. But in a very real way, they have become part of the economy of the quote unquote real world.
Right.
And I'm sure that there are a lot of people that will find that pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, let's. To try to break it down, let's talk about that virtual GDP calculation. There was a famous paper by an economist named Edward Castronova, came out in 2001, 2002, in which he looked at the game EverQuest, which was then the most popular of these games. And he knew that these items, this gold, these weapons, even the levels of experience that you would acquire in the game, had real-world value to some people, because he could look at the eBay auctions and say, okay, the price of the virtual platinum piece, which was the currency of EverQuest, is, you know, a thousand to the dollar, and I can go to the marketplace in, you know, downtown Fantasy World, wherever it is that, that EverQuest took place, and I know that this sword sells for, you know, 20,000 platinum pieces. So I know that the value of that sword is $20 in real-world terms. And so then he went and interviewed players and said, well, how much of this stuff do you acquire on a monthly basis? And established and generalized and said, there is this much of this stuff being produced in a given year in this game, and I can assign a value to it by looking at the prices on eBay. And he came up with, it was, I think, $143 million for the GDP of EverQuest, which was small as countries go. But when you broke it down per capita, it was up, you know, it was pretty good around Russia, China, that kind of, well, actually well above China's
at the time. Not inconsiderable.
Yeah. So what that means is that the, you know, what boggles the mind of people when they first hear about that is this idea that there is some kind of solid line between these play worlds, these virtual worlds, and the real economy outside of them. But if you break it down economically, you look at it the way an economist looks at it, it's really just another country with its own currency system. You know, people say, well, this money in the game is not real money. And I say, well, you get this money by doing things for hours and hours on end that you have to do in order to get it. And if people will give up time to get a particularly valuable thing to them, it has particular value to them. And so it's really hard, once you think this through, to find the real distinction between virtual economies and real economies. I mean, we could go deeper into it and make an argument that, in fact, all economies are virtual.
Exactly.
At a certain level.
Sure.
But that's where your mind starts to go once you enter this rabbit hole.
And I think that what's really interesting is that these kinds of games certainly have commanded attention from people who think about economic issues because they're big business, because they generate a lot of income and people spend money to buy them and to play them. And you know, the game industry is a big industry.
Yeah.
But this is looking at it in a different sort of way, not the way it as an industry in the world and how much money it makes and how it compares to the movie business and all that kind of stuff. This is an entirely different set of questions.
That it's not just an industry with its own revenue. It is a platform for entire economies. And I've gone back and reworked Castronova's original data over the years, you know, to say, okay, well, if this was true for EverQuest, you know, if we take all the virtual economies out there, what is the GDP of the virtual world in general? And that the last check I think I did was in 2007, and it was up around $30 billion, which, you know, not just per capita, but as a real absolute value is sort of up there with, I think, Cyprus and Sri Lanka and things like that. Not too much of a slouch. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julian Dibble. And if you're interested in reading some more about this area, the story that we're talking about, you might take a look at his book, Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. It's published by Basic Books, is now out in paperback. It's been out a couple of years. He writes on virtual world, social media, online communities, among other things. He's non-resident fellow of Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society, and he's spending some time here on the campus of the University of Illinois as a Miller visiting professor in the College of Media and also in the Center for Advanced Study. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't exist in this world at all, okay? I barely knew it existed, but I have a couple of questions about it. Now, you've got this economy you're talking about, and it kind of overflows from both the virtual world and the real world. But it seems to me someplace there has to be kind of like a sheriff of Nottingham here. Who's going to assure you that all the conditions are being met? Who's making the money? You're going in and out of these two different systems, you know. When do you get your real dollars, and how do you know the real dollars aren't phony in some way? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, on one level, this is sort of a trivial problem. I mean, eBay deals with fraud issues all the time, and they have it pretty well worked out. If somebody isn't giving you the money that they promised for the goods that you delivered, and certainly the delivery of the goods is easy to substantiate. You log in and see if, you know, your money has been deposited in your mailbox, or back in the old days before they had mail systems in these games, you used to have to literally, you know, go meet in the middle of town. And, you know, when I was doing this every day, many times a day, I would log into Ultima Online and saddle up my pony and ride to some, you know, far distant village to deliver some gold or something. But on a broader level, you've introduced, you know, some issues that the game companies struggle with. Most of the hardcore games, like World of Warcraft, ban this practice. It's considered against the rules, and it's partly because they consider it such a burden to try to deal with the customer service issues. People do complain. I ordered a sword. I bought a sword. I bought this much virtual gold, and it was not delivered. So that becomes a burden on customer service. So it creates a kind of a whole police state mechanism in World of Warcraft, where they are constantly struggling to deal with and shut down these practices. Now, this has both political dimensions on the level of Blizzard, the company behind World of Warcraft, becoming a sort of a de facto state, where it has to deal not only with managing an economy, and some of these companies hire macroeconomists to keep track of inflation and stuff, because that can affect the player's experience. But also it takes on a geopolitical level. Now, one of the phenomena that I was not able to get into while I was writing the book, but subsequently did some writing about, was the phenomenon of gold farms, which are factories that have arisen mostly in China, where workers are paid very low wages, in China it's about 30 cents an hour, to play these games, to play World of Warcraft, to gather the goods, to harvest the things that you can harvest by killing things over and over and over and over again. Very tedious sort of activity, but formally almost indistinguishable from normal play, because the games already have this kind of tedious work ethic built into them. And these Chinese workers are paid. There are hundreds of thousands of them in China now. It's a sort of bottom rung job for a lot of young Chinese migrant laborers to sit there in these factories staring at computer screens, working in virtual worlds under pretty rough conditions. But also they're dealing with the problem that Blizzard, the company that runs World of Warcraft, is constantly trying to shut these operations down in particular.
You I understand what you're saying, but you've also slightly missed the topic I was getting at. Mm. Why is there crime inside these virtual worlds? You could steal from the people there and then go out and sell on the outside world. See what I'm saying? You can mm-hmm. blend two different criminal activities here.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some of the early games had mechanics in them that it was possible to steal from another player. Like, that was part of the game. It felt crappy if you were stolen from. It happened to me. And, you know, I felt that though it was part of the game, there was something morally wrong with this. Mm-hmm. Yet when later I went to work as a virtual trader and was offered something for sale, somebody came to me basically as a fence. You know, he had stolen something very valuable and wanted me to sell it for him for real money. It was a struggle ethically to decide what to do. Now, my colleagues in the business said, oh, you know, go ahead. It's part of the game. And so I did. But I never quite got over my twinges around of morality around that. And more to the point, in later games, that mechanic has been ruled out. So if you were to steal from somebody in a game like World of Warcraft, it typically requires that you do something like hack into their account, you know, which is already criminalized in the real world. So there's not really an ambiguity there, but you're right. There's certainly an opportunity for all kinds of theft, and World of Warcraft is experiencing a rash of password sniffers. You know, people in other countries are sending out these programs that, you know, infiltrate World of Warcraft players. They sort of sniff out World of Warcraft players and then sit on their computers sniffing for their password. And once they get it, bingo, the enemy, you know, player logs in and drains your virtual bank account and sells it, you know, to the highest bidder.
Sounds very complicated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we're at our midpoint here, first of all, so I want to make sure that people who are listening know that questions, comments are welcome. We're talking this morning with, again, Julian Dibble. He's spending some time here on the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign as a Miller visiting professor in the College of Media and at the Center for Advanced Study. He's going to be giving a talk later next month as part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative, Interpreting Technoscience. And it's some of the things that he writes about in his book, Play Money, which was published first in 2006, is now available in paper, published by Basic Books. If you're interested in it, it's a good story. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to have you talk a little bit about your experience, and this is what you write about in the book, being a virtual trader and trying to make some real money in something called Ultima Online. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Well, Ultima Online was one of the earliest of these games. It still exists. It still has maybe 100,000 players, maybe more. It's not quite as graphically sophisticated as these 3D games like World of Warcraft. It had a sort of 2.5D cartoon interface. But the virtual economy was quite complex, in some ways more complex than the ones that have followed. I mean, initially, it was fantastically realistic in economic terms. Like, you know, if too many people in one area killed too many wolves, then the sheep population would go up because the wolves weren't killing the sheep. And then, you know, the price of wool would drop because there were too many sheep. I mean, it was just crazy. And unlike the later games, they took an agnostic attitude towards this real money trading practice. They, you know, were sophisticated enough to see, well, there's not really that much of a difference. And so that was permitted in that game, and that's why I focused on that game as my, you know, for my livelihood.
Yeah. So how maybe you can talk a little bit more in a little bit more detail about how exactly you go about doing this trading in something that is a virtual good, but then also managing to find someone who is willing to pay you real money for that virtual good.
Well, again, you know, step back a bit and think about the thousands and millions of leaps of faith that are taken every single day in the economic world, you know, at every level, and particularly at the highest levels, you know, where, you know, this high financial world of, you know, derivative trading, you know, where people are buying and selling, you know, bets on the, you know, the price of corn in Sumatra in 2012. There is necessarily a leap of faith every time you make a transaction that isn't, you know, face to face, and these are going on all the time. What helps them along is the existence of institutions that sort of, you know, project that we can trust this, but are ultimately just themselves kinds of leaps of faith. So in these virtual worlds, you know, people, I think because they're already in these worlds themselves and have a direct experience of the value of virtual items to them, I don't think it's such a leap to them. Mm-hmm. For outsiders, it's more of a leap. But the people that are already immersed in this world, you know, understand that the virtual value is the only kind of value there really is, and at least, you know, directly understand that if they hand over real money, they're getting something of real value to them.
Hmm. So I said at the beginning that you set yourself this challenge when you set out on the project, and then that became a blog, and then that became this book. That what you said, well, I want to see if I could make it. How much money I can make, and could I make at least as much as I made from my freelance writing? And you did manage to make some money.
I made some money. I mean, as I said, I set out saying, well, I'm going to get rich doing this. And then I had to sort of gradually refine the challenge as I went along. I said, well, what I'm really going to do is see if I can make more money than I've made as a freelance writer. And then there was quite a learning curve, and my income was slowly trickling upwards as the months went by, but not so fast that this was really going to work. So then I said, by the end of this year, by April 15th, tax day 2004, I will have, you know, in some 1 month period made more than I've ever made on a monthly basis. So all those caveats, and I should really, you know, the subtitle of the book is How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtually. There should be an asterisk saying that millions of Britannian gold pieces is what I'm referring to, the virtual currency of Ultima Online, which trades at probably now several million to the dollar. In the last month, I earned a profit of close to $4,000. Annualized, it came to something like $47,000, which didn't quite beat my best year as a writer, but I didn't quite make the challenge, but it beats many of my years as a freelance writer and many subsequent years. And in some ways, I think I should have stuck with it. But it's also a very fast evolving scene. If I had kept at it in the way I was going about it, very mom and pop, you know, selling on eBay, I would have been shut out very quickly, because a couple years after that, eBay banned entirely the selling of this stuff, basically said, okay, we will, you know, enforce as a general rule the ban that some of these companies enforce on the trading. So that venue was shut out. And then, you know, at a certain point, you're competing with the Chinese, and that's, you know, that's a universal problem, and I could never have have kept up.
Well, that's what, again, an interesting part of the story that well, first of all, not only have there been individuals who have done what you did and found a way to make some significant money just as individuals and use technology to do that, then someone comes along and says, well, you know, we don't need to use technology to do this. We could use low-wage workers to do this. And essentially what they did was they set up an electronic sweatshop mm-hmm. where they were getting people to play the games, paying them very low wages and finding a way to make money. And then from there we get to the kind of thing you're talking about, the gold farm, where that's the term coined. I like that you said. The term was coined to describe this kind of operation. That is, you get a whole bunch of people mm-hmm. and you pay them and, you know, a small wage, what'll get them to do it, to play the game.
Right.
So that then you, who are the gold farm entrepreneur, can then take their labor and by whatever means it works out,
profit from it.
Yeah. And that it has become, that has become a kind of an industry.
And it transforms the dynamics of the game in some ways, because the Blizzard then has to, you know, again, managing at a macroeconomic level the money supply in these worlds. I mean, they have to, you know, at first they design for a world in which the typical player, you know, has to sleep and eat and, you know, all these things that make it impossible to be playing around the clock 24/7. And then suddenly there's a whole group of people in the game, these gold farms, that are running characters 24/7 that, you know, that can play the game superhumanly. And so that sort of distorts the dynamics. What has happened in China is that, you know, there's two ways to increase your efficiency. One is to go as a producer. One is to go find cheaper wage markets to maximize your profits. The other is to automate, and those two are converging now in China. A lot of the when I went to China to visit the gold farms in 2007, most of the shops were still very much manual labor, so to speak. You know, one worker sitting there playing the game at his station. Now a lot of these places are bot shops, you know, as they call them. They are mm-hmm. running robot characters, automated characters are running through, killing monsters and collecting the gold. And there will be one worker maybe babysitting, you know, a row of 10 of these machines. Because occasionally the robot will, you know, get snagged on a bush or something. They're not quite intelligent enough to do it by themselves, but they, you know, maximize the efforts of the gold farm workers, and there's just no keeping up with that. And what I did in that year, you know, as a kind of mom and pop merchant, is not something you can do now, and it's not just on the production side. On the retail side, what happened towards the end of my experiment, a company called IGE came along that was the first sort of international corporate virtual currency seller to come along and just played havoc with the small-time market that had already existed for retailing, but basically served the role, helped to bring the Chinese gold farm industry into existence, because the gold farm industry couldn't have thrived as it has without a Walmart, you know, to be the, you know, the super efficient go-between between their product and Western customers.
So how much money can your average gold farm make?
It depends, you know, when it's all basically, you know, it's all relative. The prices in China are of course much lower than, you know, and so the profits that, you know, that these gold farm factories post might seem unimpressive to us, but they're, you know, people are living very well from them. Not the workers so much. It's very, like I said, a bottom rung job, but it is a living wage, though barely so, even for them.
We are moving into about our last 15 minutes. Again, our guest this morning is Julian Dibble. Sorry about that, Julian. Julian Dibble. He is spending some time here on the campus as a Miller visiting professor in the College of Media and Center for Advanced Study. We are talking about the story that you will find in his book, Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. First came out in 2006 and is now published in paper, both the hardcover and the paperback, published by Basic Books. He writes a lot about things like virtual worlds, social media, online communities, hackers, bloggers, music, pirates, computer viruses, and associated topics. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller, Champaign County. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I ran into a friend who's gardening on Facebook. Did Facebook buy into one of these farming programs, or how did they get into it? And I don't know how you'll respond to this, but it seems to me that some theory of alienation, not necessarily the social scientist from the London Library, but would be appropriate here, because it seems to me that, you know, this a lot of people roll their eyes at this whole idea, but analyzing, and I'm curious if you have reflections on this, or whether you are in any way preoccupied with why people would do this. I mean, I'm not against playing. I think play is a wonderful thing, but when it gets to be rolled up with this kind of commerce and, you know, sweatshops in China that are de-sorting somebody so they can sell it somewhere else or whatever, however that works. I mean, that is just surreal beyond belief to my mind in this time of, what I suggested to the person that was wanting to go back and tend their virtual farm was, you know, there are things you can do right now to get ready to plant the spring that have to do with real dirt. And maybe you could apply yourself in that regard. She kind of looked at me funny, but anyway, I don't know if I guess I'll hang on and see. What do you think about this as an indication of alienation in our society of the day?
I think you have put your finger right in the center of a huge in many ways unsettling question, and certainly one that I've thought about, even specifically in terms of alienation. I mean, one of the things that I went to China looking for was that line between when play really finally becomes work. How work-like can you make your play and without turning it into work, without totally, you know, destroying all the play in it? And that's a crucial question, because I think play is sort of the opposite, not so much of work, but of alienation in some definitions. You know, one of the first people I talked to about this was for an article before I even started my experiment as a virtual trader. I talked to a construction worker in Indianapolis. I went to visit him to understand why he had, you know, spent hours and hours of his life saving up in Ultima Online to acquire a little tower that was his pride and joy, and that he eventually had to sell for $500 because he lost his job after September 11th. And, you know, I saw him on the job banging away with hammer and nails, and then I talked to him about the process of how he saved up for his tower. And he had been a blacksmith and a miner, and he had done a lot of, like, repetitive clicking and, you know, on with his mouse to mine the ore to he needed to make his swords, and over hours and hours every night, you know, after he came home from work. And formally, there didn't seem to be that much difference between his day job and his night job in these terms. And I said, you know, why did you do this then? You came home from, you know, banging with a hammer all day, and then you wanted to do this. Why? He said, well, you know, isn't that just work? He said, no, it's not work if you enjoy it, right? So there's an – which, yes, but why would you enjoy it? Well, the thing is he did, and there's an elusive something to play that's self-directed. You know, you do it because you choose to, and that's the opposite of alienation in a lot of ways. And I thought, you know, and looking at the ways that people play World of Warcraft, it's hard to tell when you look at them, when they're doing these incredibly repetitive, arduous things. Is it really play? Well, if they say it is, then it is. So I thought by looking at the gold farms, you know, I would see the real difference. You know, these people are doing it for a job and there's no play in it. The play has been wrung out of it. But the curious thing was, at the end of the first shift that I spent there watching all day, watching these guys, it's a 12-hour shift. It's grueling. These guys work 7 days a week with 1 day off a month, and they sleep in the factory, in a dormitory in the factory. So this is their world. And all they get every day is a couple of hours of free time, you know, between the end of the shift and when they have to go to bed and sleep and get ready for the next shift. So these precious moments of free time, some of them take and go and sit and watch TV. Others go hang out in their rooms and talk and smoke. But a good proportion of them knocked off, went downstairs to the internet cafe in the first floor of the building, and played World of Warcraft. Continued to play this game that they were, you know, obliged to play all day long. I mean, they were playing their own characters, so it was different. But I immediately thought of, you know, Karl Marx's passage on alienation. It's a famous passage. And one of the things he describes as the signal, you know, symptom is the worker in a factory at the end of the day tries to get as far away from that work as he can. You know, he goes and gets drunk, whatever. He does not, you know, the shoemaker does not go home and make more shoes for fun. So there's something very different from classic alienation here, but there's also ways in which alienation is shot through, just as you're pointing through, and it's confusing and unsettling. And if we had more time, I would talk more about it, but you're absolutely right.
On that specific instance, though, are they really playing? Are they working on their own? They've gotten away from the company store, as it were, and they're working to accumulate their own guilt or guild,
yes,
whatever. So they may not be. They may not see it as play. They might just say, "Well, I've gotten good at this for the man, and now I'm going to accumulate some for myself." I don't know. That is not. That still wouldn't be play. That would be somebody who wants to work another, you know.
But on the contrary, I can assure you, they were playing. They liked to play World of Warcraft, and that's what they were doing.
And did they in their minds draw a distinction between what they were doing when they were playing for themselves and just to play, apparently, in their off hours, and what they were doing when they were playing in their job at the gold farm? Did they see that as being two really different things?
Yes, they were two different things. But inevitably, you know, they would learn things in their after-hours play that helped them be better at their day jobs. Not that that was the point. And curiously, too, after I'd seen them do that, I noticed the second day I went in that the way they were working looked kind of playful. I mean, they would sort of, you know, watch over each other's shoulders to see, you know, what they were doing and giving tips and laughing when the others died or, you know, cheering when they scored a victory. So it was very hard to sort out. And so I kept digging and digging. Now, some of these guys thought it was the greatest job ever. A lot of them thought it was totally crappy and wanted to get a different job as soon as they could. Mm-hmm. So I talked to those guys, particularly the guys who really didn't think it was a great job. And I said, okay, but when you're in these moments of combat with the monster and both of your life meters are getting low and it's suddenly it's not clear which one of you is going to win, and suddenly the monster dies and you win and you're not the one who dies. And do you not still feel some glimmer of, you know, playful engagement? Does your blood not race a little? And, you know, they looked at me like it was a stupid question. They said, of course, you know, nobody wants to die, which was kind of summed it up. You just can't erase the play altogether from this.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left, at least one more caller, someone near Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hi. Well, I don't think any of us find it odd that people in a really poor country will do almost anything to make a living. I think probably what we find odd is that we're over here in this incredibly rich country and people are paying them to achieve, to get something that they didn't do on their own. But, you know, seems odd, maybe because it's the internet, it seems virtual and it seems decadent and very removed from reality, anything meaningful. But it's, think of pro sports and the millions of people that spend billions of dollars just to sit there and watch that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't seem any more idiotic or wasteful or decadent. You know, it's pretty much the same thing, just a new technology doing it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's all kinds of parallels you can draw. I mean, another is we pay people in Malaysia to put little swoosh-shaped logos onto sneakers that would be worth $20 if it didn't have the swoosh on it. And suddenly it's, you got to pay $120 for it just because this virtual abstract notion of the brand has been applied to this pair of shoes. You're absolutely right. It's, in economic terms, there's nothing that new about it. I think it's more on the end of the producers themselves. And by that, I mean both the gold farmers working in farms and the players themselves who also produce wealth through their play and the ways that work and play starts to get confused, which points to a future also in which companies start to figure out that, well, if people will do something for the play of it and I can turn their play into something productive for me, why should I pay somebody when I can get people doing this for free or even paying me for the fun of doing my work? So, this is the Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer and getting the fence whitewashed, by convincing his friends it was fun, and then actually charging them for the privilege of painting the fence for him. We're starting to see examples of this. Google has introduced an experiment called the Google Image Labeler, where you play a game with an unseen opponent collaborator, where they put up images, random images, David Hasselhoff, right? And you're supposed to come up with one, single word descriptions of what you're seeing, hunk, Knight Rider, whatever, things that apply. And if you get, the more matches you get, the higher your points. And so what this is doing is, you get some fun out of it. It's quite addictive if you've ever played it. But Google gets free image tagging that computers are still not smart enough to do. So they're enlisting the playful motivation of people to have them do work for them.
We're coming down and we have maybe about a minute or two. And this really gets to what I think are some of the big and really interesting questions that come up when you talk about the things that we've been talking about. That is, what does all of this tell us about play? And what does it tell us about economics, real-world economics? And what does that tell us about how the spread of the personal computer and the internet, how that has changed our culture and changed the way we think and changed the way we think about things like play and work? Some very, very big questions, things that you could spend lots of time talking about and write lots of papers and lots of books about.
Well, and as you've mentioned, I'll be giving a talk later in March on this, partly on this very subject of what I call ludo-capitalism, this emergence of a global economy in which play is playing an increasingly pivotal role. So starting with the simple fact that games have become a huge industry. I mean, you know, one of the biggest of the entertainment industries, possibly bigger than any of the others. But also because of the fact that as computers become more and more part of the way we produce, the manipulation of symbols, more and more production itself becomes game-like. I mean, computers, if you look at what they really are, people compare them to a lot of things. You know, they're mechanical minds or they're, you know, engines of simulation. But, you know, one of the things they really look like is games. You know, they are, you know, a program is a set of rules that, you know, if you start it up and put some input in, is going to generate an income, a victory state or a loss state or whatever. So the logic of games is really infiltrating the way the economy works. And because of that is generating the possibility for play to be enlisted in just a number of ways going forward, some promising, others disturbing. Yeah.
We will have to stop there. Our guest, Julian Dibble, is George A. Miller, visiting professor in the College of Media this spring here at the University of Illinois. The talk that he mentioned, if you're interested, is Ludo-Capitalism, Real Money from Play Economics, Economies, and How I Made It. So that's Tuesday, March 30th, 4 in the afternoon at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. It's open to anybody who would like to attend. And in the meantime, if you'd like to read more about this, you might look for his book, Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. It's published by Basic Books. Our guest is a non-resident fellow of Stanford Law School Center for Internet and Society, contributing editor for Wired magazine, has written books, essays, and papers on a number of subjects, including social media, virtual worlds, online communities. Julian Dibble, thanks very much.
My pleasure.